And welcome once again to Throttle Up. This is a radio show that showcases critical thinking and is designed to inform, delimit, empower, and amaze. And let me talk a little bit about those four things. Okay, so we're going to try to be informative here and inform you in ways that are not typical or not conventional. We're going to apply what is typically called critical thinking to the issues and problems of today, which we think is fairly unique in the world of radio. And also delimit, a strange term, but basically that means that we're going to try to delimit our thinking. We're going to open up our minds to new ideas, to innovation and creativity, and to and not be narrow-minded. I don't think any of us are, but so I don't mean to be insulting here. That's not my intention. And of course, whatever I propose here on this side of the microphone, I take it as good advice for myself also. So I'm not beyond that. So delimit is opening our minds to new ideas. Empower means that we can actually empower ourselves. Now, we may already be empowered, but we could probably use a little bit more to feel empowered with respect to the fact that we are confident and comfortable in this world that we call the world of critical thinking. And of course, amaze, you know, I know a lot of you out there would think that, why did you throw that in, Kevin? That's kind of hyperbolic. But really, I think if you use critical thinking and if you get comfortable with it and apply it to the problems in your lives, you'll be really quite amazed at how really good you are at problem solving, or what we call critical problem solving. Get into that a little bit later, which is now growing in importance. Okay, so all aboard the Throttle Up Express, powered by high velocity reason. Now, I am your host, Captain Kevin Smith, U.S. Navy retired, and I am a naval aviator trained in flying supersonic fighters. I'm a pioneer in the field of critical thinking. And, of course, high-velocity reason, which is the only way that you could do what I did. But is it applicable across the board? Is what I have learned in the area of my particular expertise, can it be applied across the board? And my answer is, of course, yes, it can be. And that's the whole idea behind Throttle Up. We can take this mainstream and we can all learn together how we can better ourselves through the power of reason. Our tagline for the show is Accelerate Beyond the Ordinary, and our motto is Employ High Velocity Reason to Achieve High Octane Performance. Our mission statement, there it is, we have a mission statement, and it's to provide our listening audience with a relatively easy yet effective way to strengthen our power of reason. Now, you notice what I'm doing here. All of, those of you that have done some investigation of the world of critical thinking and analytic reason, you notice that I am using my own advice here. And I have added to my show, which I think is kind of unique, a mission statement. And I would encourage you to start doing that. I was reviewing some material, preparing for a series of lectures, instructional videos that we're going to be doing on critical thinking for an organization in Las Vegas. And one of the missing ingredients in all of these videos and all of these lectures and all this material is they never start out with a mission statement. They never start out with explaining thoroughly and clearly and comprehensively using plain language why they are there, why they are doing this, what is the purpose of doing what they're doing. And so our mission statement, I've just read it for the show. And it's also important for us on this side as we go forward with some of the other related projects and products that we're doing. So we're going to be, again, let me read that. We're going to provide our listening audience with a relatively easy, you know, it has to be easy and accessible, yet effective way to strengthen our power of reason through the employment of critical thinking. All right. Our website is throttleupradio.com. That's throttleupradio.com. Some good stuff on the website. It's a work in progress, though, so we keep adding new features and new things on a regular basis. And then finally, the audio engineering services for Throttle Up Radio is provided by Evergroove Studios, and they are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and that is right outside of Denver. It's actually in the foothills, so just west of Denver a little ways, and it's fairly easy to get to. You can fly into Denver International Airport, and you rent a car and drive up there, and it's a very pleasant area to visit. B&Bs and some great little mom-and-pop inns that I think you would enjoy. And if you need some audio services, that would be a good group to contact. That is Evergroove Studios. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado. And, of course, you can find them just by Googling Evergroove Studios. Okay, our show, as always, our show is organized into three parts. Part one is a continuing discussion of critical thinking. And on this show, we're going to continue our discussion of this scenario that we put forward. I guess three or four shows ago, we started this scenario where we are hypothetically part of a team that has been brought together to put together an instructional program, a training program for the operators and managers of deep water oil platforms to improve their risk management skills. So it's a risk management training program. And we'll be talking about that today right away, as soon as we get into part one. And as soon as I get moving on this on this introduction phase of Throttle Up. Part two, of course, is our storyboard. It's the story of, and this week it's going to be a story, continuing story of America and what's going on socio-politically in America. And the third part, three, is our radio essay. And this week we have a rather interesting discussion on climate change. And so I think you'd want to stay tuned for that. When I was putting it together, I also found it to be kind of fascinating myself, if I have to admit it. I know it sounds a little self-serving, but we can have fun with it, and we can have fun with the show, which is what we try to do. All right, so all aboard the Throttle Up Express. This is a place where all critical thinkers are welcome with open arms, and hopefully where America finds solutions. All right, so let's press on to part one. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up Part One. And part one, of course, is our continuing discussion of critical thinking. And this continuing discussion is a scenario. So let's imagine, if you will, let's imagine that you and I are part of this tiger team that has been brought together by this company, this firm that is well established in the field of corporate training. And there's a bunch of them out there, and they all do good work, I'm sure. I know some of them, and I've done some consulting work with some of them. But nevertheless, let's use our imagination, okay? And that's one of the, I guess, defining characteristics of Throttle Up, is that we like to do that, and we like to exercise our intellect instead of just making it a one-way conversation. So just imagine that we're part of this tiger team, and I want you to put on your thinking cap also, which your thinking cap says, I'm a critical thinker, or I think critically, however you want to have it embroidered on your thinking cap. That's probably not a bad idea. Maybe I should offer some of those for sale on my website. So that just sort of like popped into my head. So let me have my graphics artist, Jennifer, take a look at that. That might be something that we could have fun with. All right. So, and also maybe some coffee mugs. Anyway, so let's imagine that. Let's imagine that we are a part of this team, and we've been brought together to solve a very serious problem. And the problem was manifested in a tragic accident aboard the Deepwater Horizon oil platform, where 11 amazing human beings, 11 people were killed. It was turned into a movie of the same name. And of course, I would highly recommend it, but look at it, and you may want to see it more than once, and that's okay. But if you look at it through the prism of critical thinking, you begin to see things that are just below the surface here, that if it was accurately portrayed, and I think it was, and I have read the accident report on it and did some study and saw the movie a couple of times. So we look at it from the prism of critical thinking. And so what we're going to try to do, we're going to try to address ourselves to risk management in complex operations. And specifically, we're going to call it complex problem solving, or problem solving in a complex environment. It means the same thing. So we'll use the term complex problem solving because it's fairly common and well known. So this is another of ongoing meetings. So we have another meeting in the conference room of our company, and sitting around the table is all of us. And the leader of the group reads this once again. And we have talked about this on numerous occasions on the show. In the 2016 Future of Jobs report, and this was published by the World Economic Forum, and they predicted that by the year 2020, critical thinking and complex problem solving will be the most in-demand set of skills in the global job market, but also the hardest to fill. Okay, so we read that, and now we begin to understand why we're in this organization, why we're in this team, and how we can begin to address ourselves to the customer's problem. All right, so what we're going to be doing here is not all that unusual today. It probably was unusual maybe 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago. But today, what we are doing in this imagined reality that we've got going here is not all that unusual. More and more companies are thinking of themselves as solutions-based enterprises, and they like this idea of team organization where they put together these short-lived mission teams. They're now calling them mission teams, which I think is a pretty good term. So we are part of this mission team, and our job is to take a look at this area or this arena that exists on these offshore platforms, these deep water oil platforms, which are actually floating entities. They're not anchored to the ocean floor, to my based upon my understanding. Okay, so we are part of this team, and this week, part of our weekly meetings this week, we have an expert that came in to help us get our arms around this whole thing that we call complexity, or complexity management, or how to become a complexity master. So how do we manage complexity, and how do we then understand complexity with respect to complex problem solving? So if we have a problem solving challenge that is complex, all right, are we going to just dive right into solving this problem like it's a one-off event, or are we going to not do that, but we're going to be smarter? We're going to be a little bit more intuitive and a little bit more intellectual here, and we're going to be talking about, or we're going to be considering, what does it mean when we say complex? What aspects of reality are considered to be complex? So we brought in this expert from the Santa Fe Institute, and they are located in, of course, Santa Fe, New Mexico. And it's a real location. I have not been there. I have talked to these folks on the phone, and I have visited their website. And it's at some point in time, I will be visiting them. It's on my short list. Anyway, the whole purpose of being is to study and to spread the word of how we go about understanding complex systems. So it's complexity theory is what they're all about. They're kind of outside the mainstream, not quite so much anymore. There's more and more individuals and organizations that are becoming more interested in complexity theory and complex systems. And so they're kind of like leading the charge, if you will. They're on the leading edge of this thing, and they've been around a long time, right? And so I would encourage you to go look them up on the web, Santa Fe Institute. I don't actually know what the exact web address is, but just Google Santa Fe Institute and you'll find it. All right, so this expert comes in, and he's going to talk about the complexity, this whole thing that we call complexity. All right, so he starts off his briefing this way. He says, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be examining what we call the world of complex things. Well, that's piqued our interest. What does he mean by complex things? I thought complex things were just like one thing among many, and he's using the plural. So let's see if we can kind of figure this one out. And he says, all right, now remember that complex things is a general term, and complex things represents an aspect of reality that exists for a reason or a purpose. In some cases, the reason may contain some unfortunate elements. Complex things can be either a space, a situation, or a mechanism. Complex things then exhibit certain properties that are considered, of course, complex. A complex space is a space that is located within a particular environment that contains a number of objects or agents performing dynamically and often in a nonlinear way. Nonlinearity, I think, is another term, operating in adverse or hostile conditions under increased time compression. Okay, so that's kind of a mouthful. And so we're reading our notes or taking notes, and we're trying to understand, okay, so complex things consist of complex spaces, all right, complex situations, or complex mechanisms. So we have space, situation, and I guess a mechanism is an object or it's a thing. It's a physical thing, if you will. Fair enough. A complex space can be referred to as a problem space, a battle space. That's a military term. Problem space is the same. Battle space and problem space are essentially the same, except in the military operation, in the military lingo, they call it a battle space, which is okay. And that's fine, because I kind of like to use both of them. If we're talking in a non-military way, we'll use the term problem space. If we're talking in a military way, we'll call it battle space. And so it's either a battle space, problem space, or a mind space. Mind space is a new term, and I'll get to that in a second. It may also be referred to as a frame of reference, a field of play, a volume of interest, and finally, an operational envelope. Now, they basically mean they mean all the same thing. But think of them as a space. They're not an object. All right. This is a location in time and space. This is a location, and the location has boundaries to it. And it could be a big place or it could be a small place, but we have to define it. We have to define what we call this problem space and define the boundaries by which this problem space is created or defined. Sorry about that. I'm using that too much. But the way it's understood, the way problem space is understood is to use boundaries and then figure out what's inside the boundaries. Okay, so the defining characteristics of such a space is that it exhibits properties that are considered complex and contain within its boundaries a purposeful operation or mission intended to achieve certain desirable objectives. An example of a complex space is a battle space consisting of friendly and hostile air, land, and sea forces operating within certain boundary conditions, which may contain additional adversities. A mind space, by the way, may contain a complex entity called a conceptual structure, but it remains non-physical. Okay? A complex situation. A complex situation may emerge from a particular space residing within its boundaries. Complex situations are typically understood as self-contained occurrences, but this is inaccurate and wrong. Situations always occur within a bigger picture, and considerations of the big picture is always important, notwithstanding what the situation is. Consequently, a situation or occurrence will always reside within a problem space or battle space containing other objects or hostile agents that will have an impact on mission success. Okay, I've got one more thing before I go. Complex systems. A complex mechanism is also called a big mechanism or a complex system. A complex system are big mechanisms, either natural or man-made, that are vital because they can do things that otherwise cannot be done, providing benefits far exceeding whatever resources they consume. Examples of complex systems are numerous and include such things as economies of modern industrial societies, a naval task force, a military expeditionary force, global manufacturing and distribution, a modern airliner, a flight of military tactical aircraft, a new product development cycle, the weather cycle, any large-scale adaptive system, or, for example, a tropical ecosystem. Such systems exhibit properties that are complex and uncertain. This complexity and uncertainty are areas in which specialized inquiry methods are necessary, inasmuch as traditional piecewise inquiry methods are ineffective and will almost always lead to the wrong conclusions. Okay, that's pretty profound, but that completes our discussion today with this gentleman or lady who has, actually, they're both of them. There's two of them that have hypothetically come in from this NFA Institute, and they're talking to us about what is this that we call the world of complex things. All right, so we'll continue this next week and in future shows. Now let's press on to part two. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Part Two. Part two is our storyboard, and our story for this week is the continuing story of America, and it's an unreported story. It's a story of American prosperity, And it's an unreported story for reasons that are, well, that are quite disturbing and unsettling. But nevertheless, we're going to be talking about it. And we're talking about it in the context that this is an unreported story that should be getting lots and lots of press, but it's not. Now, the story of America takes an unexpected turn in that what has captured mainstream and social media is not good news, but dire predictions. And so somebody is feeding us a bunch of BS, and that is most of the mainstream media and most of the social media. They're feeding us junk, fake news, whatever you want to call it. I call it intellectual nonsense. Nevertheless, this is because good news is by and large being suppressed. Now, a few radio show hosts, I can point out, I think the one that stands out in my mind is Laura Ingraham. I think Scott Adams on this network in the Scott Adams Show is another good source where they will point out this great economic news. Now, the reason why, I'm going to cover just very briefly, the reason why this is being suppressed, and this is not necessarily a unique idea to Kevin or something that I came up on my own. I think others have done great service in bringing this idea out into the marketplace of ideas. Now, as Richard Thieme points out on his website, themeworks.com, that's T-H-I-E-M-E, themeworks.com, as well as Holman Jenkins of the Wall Street Journal. They both more or less say this: hostile agents have entered the mind space of the citizens, employing cognitive mechanisms that are specifically designed to enhance the plausibility of a proposition that is in and of itself devoid of facts, logic, and coherence, and cannot objectively be represented as the truth. Such cognitive mechanisms include constant and unrelenting repetition of a proposition or an assertion that has already been determined to be, through the application of critical thinking and analytic reasoning, to be false. So, we come to some reality, and that is good news, all right? Notwithstanding what's going on in the mainstream arena, which I think is an alternate universe, frankly. I don't think it's part of our normal world. I think these people live in an alternate universe. They may or may not believe what they say, but given the fact that they do have some belief in what they're saying, which makes no sense, they are living in some kind of an alternate universe. In the universe that we live in, that you and I live in, the U.S. economy is a subject of our discussion this week. The U.S. economy is hitting milestones and performing in such a way that has not been seen in quite a while. More than a decade, in fact. For example, unemployment rate is 4.1%. Non-farm payrolls in October increased by 244,000, and in November it increased by 228,000. Economic growth is now firmly at 3%, and it's been at 3% for some time now. Business investments are accelerating. Stocks have hit record highs. Consumer confidence remains strong. The American economy is growing at a much healthier pace, which means that goods and services are being produced in greater quantities and customers are being found for such goods and services in record numbers. A higher growth plane over the past 9 months has occurred. Growth in the GDP has hit 3% in the second and third quarters, propelling a heating up of the economy. Most industries are on the economic express, thanks to President Trump and his Commerce Secretary, William Ross. The housing market is doing especially well, but some shortages in materials are starting to materialize. So I'm sorry about that. Materials are materializing. I read that. I wrote this a little while ago, and I realized that that's probably poorly said. But nevertheless, we make mistakes or would like to redo things from time to time. I guess that's just being human. Small business optimism, by the way, is especially good news because it was previously depressed. Small businesses are growing, adding new employees, opening additional storefronts and restaurant locations. And in my small retirement community here in Nevada, new construction is everywhere and new restaurants are opening. I think two new restaurants have opened just in the last month or two. So we're even seeing it here. The labor market is tightening, however, which is both good and bad news, but is especially good for the veterans community as they enter the civilian job market. But what does the labor market need people to perform? Well, what do they need? Well, you know, we can go through the list. You know, this is not rocket science. You can go through the list and you can see what is going on across the country. We need deliveries of stuff. We need warehousing, inventory management, people working in food service. We, of course, need lots of truck drivers and airline pilots and teachers. And, of course, critical thinkers and complex problem solvers. Why is that? Because as we enter into the economic mainstream of a modern industrial society, things are going to become more complex. There are greater opportunities out there, of course, but things are going to become more complex, and you're going to have to consider things that we didn't have to think about 50 years ago or even 25 years ago. And here's one example of that. Team I work with, we're preparing a series of instructional videos for a particular internet TV channel, which is up and running. And these instructional videos, we need to not only produce the products and deliver the products in various digital mediums, but we also need to advertise. So I just talked to my graphics artist about putting together a media package for this particular endeavor. So that's an example. And some of the stuff gets kind of complex. And so we need people to be able to do that. And by and large, those people can be found. It takes a little bit of looking, but by and large, those people can be found. They exist in, or they could very well come from a number of places. And the place that I'm familiar with is, of course, the veterans community. It doesn't mean that we're exclusive or any exclusivity associated with any of that. But the veterans community does have people that can actually engage in complex problem solving and do quite well. Now, the most striking part of the labor market is the declining jobless rate. Listen to this. I mean, this is like flies in the face of conventional wisdom. I love it. You know, the most striking part of the labor market is the declining jobless rate among workers over 25 without a high school diploma. Now, everybody was telling you and me, for all the experts were saying, well, these people are gone. We need to forget about them in this new information age. We can't employ people like that. You know, we're going to have to be compassionate and put them on welfare. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case at all. These folks are supposed to be the least employable for various offered reasons. But in the November jobless rate for these workers fell, the November jobless rate for these workers fell to 5.2% from 6.5% in September. And this is the lowest that this rate has been any time since 1992. That's quite incredible. It's also encouraging, and I'm delighted with that. And I wish all of those people the very best in their newfound positions and jobs and careers. Arguably, the biggest reason for the improved economic performance is the drastic alteration of the regulatory climate with respect to the American economy. Regulation may be good for socialism, but it dampens and degrades economic performance everywhere it is tried. So the economic prosperity model, if in fact we have one, and we actually don't, but we will be discussing that, and we will come up with a what I would call a working model for the American Economic Prosperity Initiative. Now, this model does not yet exist, but it should. According to conventional wisdom, it ought to contain international trade and immigration to maintain a pool of available workers. And that basically is about as far as people go with that. They might also include minimum wage, and they might also include job retraining and stuff like that. But none of it is, you know, is comprehensive. It's all ad hoc. And it may contain other components. But as of yet, we are not, we don't really have one. And so next week, we will discuss such a model. So next week, I will offer to my listening audience a working model of what I call the American prosperity, economic prosperity model for America. Okay, that's the economic prosperity model for America. All right, that's it for part two. And now we're going to press on to part three. Okay, welcome back to part three of Throttle Up. Part three, of course, is our radio essay. And today we're going to be looking at, well, we're going to be doing a book review, looking at, I'm sorry, we're going to be doing a book review. And the book is called An Inconvenient Deception, How Al Gore Distorts Climate Science. Another term I would use for this book, which is my own term, by the way, is the climate change dilemma. Now, this book is written by Dr. Spencer, and this is a sequel to The Inconvenient Truth. An Inconvenient Sequel is the name of it. Truth to Power. It appeared in theaters. Well, actually, it's a book in a video. So it's not just a book review. It's a book and video review. And it appeared in theaters in July of 2017. Okay. But before we get into this book and video that was, starring our good friend Al Gore. Sorry, I said that rather sarcastically. Anyway, so before we get into that, I want to take a brief marginal tour here and talk a little bit about the discussion of climate change and the climate atmosphere and the weather from the perspective of critical thinking. Now, climate, atmosphere, and weather are not the same, but they are interconnected. And in the words of complex systems theory, they are interacting variables. So we have to be very clear and very exact when we talk about climate and we talk about atmosphere and we talk about weather. So that all is something that we need to keep in mind. Okay, so the first thing that we, in any of our discussions, the first thing that we need to do is we need to understand what we're talking about, or what is the problem space, if you will. And we talked a little bit about that in the last section. But what is a problem space? What are we dealing with? Well, we're first and foremost, we're dealing with atmosphere. And what is the atmosphere? What is the Earth's atmosphere? Well, vertically, it consists of various more or less arbitrary layers that we have labeled it for the convenience of science and weather analysis and the convenience of air travel. But the atmosphere consists of nitrogen at 78%. So I'm at 78% nitrogen. The atmosphere also consists of oxygen, which is about 20%. Water in the form of water vapor is about 4%. And carbon dioxide is part of the atmosphere, but it's in the quantities that are extremely low. Carbon dioxide is 0.036% of the Earth's atmosphere. So carbon dioxide, or CO2, represents less than 0.5% of all atmospheric gases. Now keep that in mind as we discuss things further about this thing called climate change. Okay, so what are, with respect to that, what are the greenhouse gases? All right, so the greenhouse gases consist of water vapor. Now, this is pretty amazing. You're going to find this pretty amazing, as I have done. Now, I'm not a climate scientist or anything like that, but I am a critical thinker, and I use critical thinking as much as possible, particularly when I'm trying to examine a particular issue or assertion or solve a particular problem. So the greenhouse gases, greenhouse means that the suspended gases in the atmosphere provide some kind of a blanket or some kind of protection against solar radiation, losing heat, if you will, or heat radiating off the planet through the atmosphere. So there is some protection or a blanket of gases that more or less keeps the surface of the Earth and the atmosphere of the Earth a bit warmer than it otherwise would be. And that's beneficial for us because we're not that close to our sun, or the sun is not enormously big. In fact, it's just a medium-sized sun. But water vapor consists of 70%. So the majority of the greenhouse gases are suspended water or water vapor. Carbon dioxide is approximately 20%, followed by methane at about 5% and ozone at about 5%. So water vapor and carbon dioxide make up 90% of the gases. And then the remaining 10% are these rare gases, methane and ozone, okay? Now, taking out carbon dioxide for a moment, and just setting that aside, we have water vapor at 70%. We have methane at 5%, ozone at 5%. That's 80% of the greenhouse gases do not consist of carbon dioxide. So we're talking about carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. It contributes only 20% of the effect of greenhouse gas characteristics, 20%. So whatever we do will affect the atmosphere to the maximum of 20%. Now, keep that in mind, because mathematically and analytically, whatever we're trying to do here with carbon dioxide just makes no sense, because it's not going to have any kind of appreciable effect on the greenhouse characteristics of the atmosphere one iota. So with non-carbon greenhouse gases pegged at 80%, and with carbon gas representing 20% of the gases that are characteristically greenhouse. So if we double carbon gases in the atmosphere, then will its percentages change with respect to the other gases? And the answer is rather interesting. So let's assume for the moment, all right, that we are going to double the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. So we go from, let's say, 200 parts per million to 400 parts per million of carbon molecules in the atmosphere, or carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so what happens to that carbon? Does the carbon percentage of carbon gas increase and others decrease? No, that's not how it works. Now, one of the characteristics of this atmosphere or this planet is pretty remarkable. It's called a carbon cycle. The carbon goes through various cycles. It goes through gas, liquid, and solids. And because of the carbon cycle, which is very complex, by the way, so the atmospheric characteristics and the carbon cycle all work together in a very complex macro system. Now, what happens to the carbon? The carbon does not necessarily increase. If we increase the percentage of carbon in the atmosphere by 100%, what happens to it? Well, more than half of the carbon emitted is, in fact, removed by the atmosphere over the course of about 100 years. So if there is a huge increase in carbon due to volcano eruptions or due to burning of fossil fuels and stuff like that, the atmosphere has a capacity, a built-in mechanism by which carbon then is somehow taken out of the atmosphere and put into other forms. And so it becomes non-atmospheric carbon. Now, you know, nobody really talks about that. You know, in not only that, but carbon dioxide is essential for life. And carbon dioxide, being 20% of the greenhouse gases, that not only has greenhouse characteristics, but it also has life-giving characteristics. Because without carbon or carbon dioxide, carbon, life would not exist. The plants have to have carbon dioxide. They have to be able to breathe it. And so it's a life-giving atmospheric gas. And so we have characterized carbon as being something nasty, and it actually isn't. Okay, so with that in mind, let's talk about this book and video that was recently released that starred Al Gore, and it was, it was the second in the series of climate change videos they're trying to promote. It's actually climate change propaganda is what it is. How it gets in the theaters, I have the foggiest idea. I don't think anybody has ever watched it. The reports of that I have gotten is that nobody watches this movie. That's not interesting. Anyway, so the book starts off with warming temperatures, and the assertion is that rising global temperatures characterize as a problem. Okay, so rising global temperatures are characterized as a problem. That's the assertion. All right, what's the actual? The actual is the temperatures over the last 50 years have risen about 0.2 degrees Celsius for each decade. And so we have five decades times 0.2. So over the last 50 years, temperature has risen 1 degree centigrade. That's it, 1 degree. Commentary. actual temperatures observed go back only 100 to 150 years. So beyond that, we must infer from secondary sources using inferred data going back 2,000 years, the Roman warm period and the medieval warm period were warmer than it is now. Okay, so that pretty much debunks that one. Conclusion, current global temperature rise is of no consequence. Greenland melting is the second thing in the movie and the book that I will discuss here. So Greenland melting was characterized as being a problem, being catastrophic. And so what in my, my answer is, well, so what, Greenland is currently almost all ice. So if some ice is melting, so what, the assertion is, well, this will cause coastal flooding, not likely. And this is not likely because more fresh water will be absorbed by the atmosphere. Greenland was considerably warmer in times past, and when it was warmer, England did not disappear under the water. Okay, so that's my comment on that ridiculous assertion. Receding glaciers all over the northern hemisphere. And this is really important, and this is completely missing in most commentaries. And I have seen this firsthand, so let me get into this. This is particularly important. And we only have a few minutes left. Receding glaciers all over the northern hemisphere reveals ancient mature forests that were buried under the ice, signifying much warmer climate in the years past. And this goes back to thousands of years. All right. So receding glaciers have revealed these ancient forests. Now I have seen this personally. It was probably a few years ago, I guess, where I was traveling on the Icefield Highway. Now, I was traveling on the Icefield Highway on my motorcycle, and the Icefield Highway is in Alberta. It's near British Columbia, and it's right along the spine of the Rocky Mountains. And it's a highway, rather famous highway and scenic highway, and it is between Lake Louise and Jasper Park. And we are going to, now we're just getting into a really interesting part of the show. And now I see that I have basically run out of time again. I promised to cover this next week. So please forgive me for not managing my time better, but this is a rather revealing and interesting first-hand account of this ridiculousness that we call climate change. All right, so I can see by the clock on the wall that I have now come to my conclusion of another Throttle Up Radio show. I am glad to be here. It is an honor. I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for allowing us the opportunity to put on this show every week. And it's on every weekend now, three times every weekend on Red State Talk Radio on both channels. Thank you, my listeners, for being here. And I would also like to thank our veterans, those in the listening audience who are veterans. Thank you for your service. And we will see you all next week on another Throttle Up.